I'm Stephanie Wilson, and you're listening to Freedom Over Fascism.
Fact-checking Trump will never work because he's telling the truth. The truth is power, right? Mm-hmm. I have power, and they can see that. The rest, oh my God, these fools quibbling over, you know, this detail or that detail, missing the forest for the trees. That's the question when we were talking before about fact-checking. You can't fact-check power, right? You can't fact-check a myth, as I argue in the book, partly because the myth is in service of power. And if it's working, it's working. It's not, right. It throws it out.
Hi, friends. I hope you had a thoughtful Thanksgiving. Before we start today's interview, I want to congratulate our guest, Jeff Charlotte, for making the New York Times notable book list with his book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Jeff and I spoke in September 2023, just 2 months ago. I'm happy to bring this interview back to you as we learn more and more about MAGA's plans if they win the presidency. When Jeff and I first talked, we discussed the civil war that's already started in America. We talked about the social movement on the right, based in white Christian nationalism, which is a fascist movement with Trump as its avatar. Please listen to that discussion because it's more relevant now than it was even 2 months ago. Once again, we need to think about the stakes of every single election and ignore the polls that are talking about the horse race. As Jay Rosen, who I still want to get on this podcast, says, not the odds, but the stakes. First, this is what Trump said at a Veterans Day rally in New Hampshire. The crowd went wild. Quote, "We pledge to you that we will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country, that lie, cheat, and steal on elections. They'll do anything, whether legally or illegally, to destroy America and to destroy the American dream. The threat from outside forces is far less sinister, dangerous, and grave than the threat from within. Our threat is from within." End quote. Calling people vermin has been a precursor to genocidal violence around the world. Nazis called Jews vermin before killing more than 6 million. In Rwanda, Hutu leaders called the other Rwandan ethnic group, the Tutsis, vermin before Hutus went on a genocidal rampage, killing 1 million Tutsis in about 100 days in 1994. So these are the stakes if Trump wins. Keep in mind his dehumanizing language, which is often the precursor to large-scale violence and genocide. Peter Wenner of The Atlantic says, quote, "Trump is doing two things at once, pushing the narrative that his enemies must be defeated while dissolving the natural inhibitions most human beings have against hating and harming others. It signals to his supporters that any means to vanquish the other side is legitimate. The normal constraints that govern human interactions no longer apply." Against this backdrop is Project 2025, which is the roadmap that Trump advisors have published for what will happen first if he's elected president. You can find all 1,000 pages in a document on the Project 2025 website hosted by the Heritage Foundation in partnership with a lot of other right-wing think tanks. Here are the first things Trump would do. The first would be to politicize the Justice Department to go after anyone he considers a political enemy, including former members of his own administration. After that, he'd use the Insurrection Act to deploy the U.S. military on the streets of this country. He would bypass the Senate confirmation process to put his allies in top positions, and he plans to crack down on immigrants and put them in concentration camps while they're waiting for deportation. This wouldn't be on a one-by-one basis. He'd round up immigrants en masse. Then he'd plan mass deportations. Millions of people would be rounded up and put into camps, even if they've been in the United States for decades, completely legally. Sound familiar? He'd also purge the civil service, putting in place thousands of political allies. When I talked to Jeff We talked a lot about what he found on his trip across the country.
Going to Trump rallies, attending gun church services, and chatting with the congregants, meeting with whoever would talk to him. And what he found is that the Trumpers, radical right-wing churchgoers and militia members, belong to a social movement that believes that a civil war is coming and they're armed and waiting for it to begin. And while some of these folks look like Nazis with swastika tattoos announcing their fascism, many more look like you and me. They're pleasant, polite people we might meet anywhere, as parents of school kids, baristas, and oddly enough, nurses. But they believe that they, white Christian nationalists, are the only folks entitled to be real Americans. And surprisingly, they're not all actually white. Black and brown folks belong to this movement as well, engaged by the promise of whiteness and belonging. But there's an element of the slow civil war that's happening in plain sight. Those of us in MAGA-captured states recognize it, but many others of us in red states and theoretically safe blue states are complacently looking at it as politics as almost usual. I'm talking here about MAGA politicians' war against Americans. I've spoken about it before, but I want to dive a little deeper into this idea. At the state level, we know from our conversation with Dr. Katie McHugh that maternal mortality is going way up in places where abortion is banned. That's another battle in the slow civil war. MAGA criminalizing trans people and making it impossible for them to get appropriate health care is another salvo in the slow civil war. MAGA cozying up to the Russia-funded NRA and pumping more guns into civilian hands is part of the slow civil war. MAGA refusing to consider gun sense legislation is part of the war. Please keep listening because our conversation touches a lot of places that aren't obvious from the beginning. Jeff Charlotte is a talented storyteller in print and in conversation. Listen for the speed, tone, and timbre of his voice as he talks. That's as much a valuable part of our conversation as the words themselves.
Tuesday, November 28th is Giving Tuesday. I ask you to consider donating to support this podcast by becoming a paid subscriber at HoosierVictoryAlliance.substack.com or a patron at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. Please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Now for our conversation. Jeff Charlotte, welcome to Freedom Over Fascism.
Hi, Stephanie. Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. I wanted to talk a little bit today about your book, but also not just your book, more about the moment that we find ourselves in as a country and whether the concept of civil war is right. What does fascism mean? Looking from a sort of a bigger national perspective, is the same as it is in a lot of states where reality is different. You live in Vermont, I live in Massachusetts, although I do a lot of work in Indiana. And my reality is very different than Indiana's reality, which is very different from Vermont's reality. So I wonder if you would tell me what your thoughts are about the idea that you put forth that we are in a slow civil war. And what does that mean for us in this moment?
Well, so yeah, the subtitle of the book, Scenes from a Slow Civil War, and that really became the subtitle kind of on January 6, 2021. And I had already been working on the book and I'd been thinking I had this collection of essays that I thought illustrated what I mean by the title, the undertow, the currents that have been bringing us to this moment. And, you know, if you think about the right and social movements in America for a long time, it wasn't as surprising. January 6, 2021, I'm watching just like everybody else. And no matter how long you could spend, anyone that says, oh, well, I wasn't surprised. Nonetheless, I was surprised. I was stunned. And when I saw a big piece of the book is about this woman named Ashley Babbitt, a woman in her 30s, white woman, Air Force veteran, J6er, and was killed leading a charge and was killed by a police officer who was black. And so I knew that was going to feed right into the kind of white supremacist, racist martyr myth. And I decided to explore the formation of that martyr myth. And that was the spring of 2021 at a time when scholarly historians, academic historians were starting to talk with this language of civil war. which has always been a kind of a fringe language, mainly on the right. But people were talking, and political scientists looking at conditions, like Barbara F. Walter and her book, How Do Civil Wars Start? The historians especially, I'm married to an academic historian, I know that they, in fact, are very cautious and know that history usually moves very slowly. But here they were using this. So I decided to go out and talk to folks. My first thing was like, okay, what happens when I say civil war to people traveling around the country? And I was talking to people for whom Ashley Babbitt was a name they recognized, for whom she was a martyr. And the only question about civil war was not so much did they think one was coming, but whether or not they looked forward to it, whether it was a regrettable necessary or a thrilling cleansing. Either way, they expected it to come. That doesn't mean we're going to have the blue versus the gray. We're not. No. It may mean we never even have open conflict. I hope not. But I think we are in the slow civil war. We are already having casualties. I think telling ourselves, people said, do you think it could come to political violence? I mean, what do you mean, could? We live in a time of political violence. Mass shooters like Drumbeats, and the book I read, their manifestos, I know what's informing them. All the deaths of pregnant people dying for lack of reproductive rights, the wave of trans and queer youth suicide. Now, suicide's complex, but there's no question that there is a fear associated with it. All the little violences that don't make any news at all. One person beats their partner, a political conflict in a family, a kid runs away, or the public terrors, the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys and Three Percenters lining up with their guns outside school libraries, right? That's what I mean by slow civil war. I believe, and I think I can argue, there are casualties. We're in this now. We acknowledge it so that we can stop it from becoming a full, fast war.
I'm actually really glad to hear you say that, because I think for a lot of people, as you described, the idea that we would come to this, we feel like we're at the end of history, right? That what we are is a culmination of everything that's come before, but we can't quite conceive of what's coming next. I'm a historian by training, and I've been thinking about and using the language of civil war for years now. And anytime I actually said it out loud, which wasn't frequently, I'd get, oh, come on, what are you talking about? Of course, that's not what's going on. And in the course of this podcast, we talked to Ryan Bussey, who is now running for governor of Montana, but wrote his book about the gun industry. And he said to us, he was one of our first guests, and he said, they are at war with you. Whether or not you know it, they have been at war with you for the last 15 years. And every single thing is connected, and it is by design. And I hadn't quite put it to myself that way. I knew that the right was, you know, coming after women's reproductive freedoms, about trans kids and adults' ability to define themselves, gun violence, you know, all of the things that we are looking at right now separately. And then when you start to put it together, you do realize that it's all part of the same phenomenon. And hearing you talk about it, reading your book, I think brings it together in a way that we really need to start thinking more. That is the same thing. We see people say, well, you know, the Republicans can't stand up to the NRA. Well, they don't want to, right? It's not like they don't know what's happening. I feel like there's this idea that we're looking at MAGA and that they just don't know how to govern.
Yeah. I think the history of social movements there becomes important. And, right. And you and I know this, but I also often encounter folks on the left who think that social movement is a term that belongs to us.
Right.
The social movement's a good thing. Social movement is what the NRA claims a gun is. You know,
right.
What you do with it is what happens, right?
Right.
And I think we can talk about the F word, fascism. I think it's a fascist movement. And what it really represents from my perspective is writing about different right-wing organizations and so on, mostly throughout the 20th century in the United States and current times and so on, is that we're in this moment of extraordinary convergence. I look at the prosperity gospel. I look at celebrity culture and the way all these things start flowing in until that current starts pulling you out there, right? And mm-hmm. Christian nationalism and white supremacy. We speak of, you said the Civil War was a term that people used to say, oh, come on. So was white supremacy. I mean, you know, if 10 years ago I had written and, you know, for the magazines that I write for, mainstream magazines, if I'd use the term white supremacy, the editor probably would stop me. Now we understand it, right? And the same, we saw that same thing happen in November 2021. There was some of us saying, hey, this is a slow motion coup. And then there was some of us were saying, oh, give me a break. Don't be hysterical.
Right.
That kind of died out after January 6th. And now civil war is a question you can see discussed on the pages of the New York Times. And yet we're still in a moment. Been lucky the book has gotten good reviews. And there was a review on the New Yorker, and it was a good review. It's a smart guy. But he ended it. It was a review of three other books, or two other books, Wesley Lowery's book and David Nywaert's book, and these books on the right. And he says, yeah, but come on. You know, sooner or later, the people are going to see through Trump. You just, wait a minute. We have gone in a period of time where now white supremacy, fascism, civil war, these are all terms you can use in polite society. Not everyone's going to agree, but it's a debate. That's the direction we're going. When I came up with that title for the book, I was worried, scenes from a slow civil war. Ah, what if things have all cooled out by then? Trump is away and my book is obsolete. And I hope so. That would be great. We're closer now than when it published in March. We're still going in that direction. It's not too late. Nothing is inevitable. You know, the end of history, you as a historian know, never comes. And I think that's the panic that fascism wants to induce in us, right? This is why in the beginning, the preface of the book is called Our Condition. And I reject the term crisis. I reject crisis of democracy. Right. I reject climate crisis. That suggests that here we are at the cliff and either we're going to live or we're going to die. What happens if Trump becomes president in 2024? We wake up the next day and you continue the struggle. And that could happen. It's not the end of the world. It's the next day in a very frightening one. But that's
all it is. I know. I remember when Obama, it was like one of the last things he said. He said, it's not the end of the world until it's the end of the world.
I think Obama actually does use it in like an overly reassuring way, that the center will always hold. That's that New Yorker review I'm talking about, is sort of saying it's a little bit, you know, what you were saying, the NRA and the Republican Party. The center did not hold. There isn't a center anymore. In as much as there is, you and me are not it. And I think a lot of educated liberals still say, how do we talk sense to these people? How do we bring them back into the fold? Like, bring them back into the fold. We're out here on the fringe. We are the fringe now. We're not the mainstream of American life. And I think that switch of understanding where we are helps us get a better grip on the work to be done.
I think it does, but I'm not sure how fringe we are or whether they're trying to make us believe we're fringe, right? So I'm out there working in Indiana, where the reality is that that state, along with so many others, are in a state of relative fascism. There's a supermajority of these MAGA people who want to take away rights. They already have banned abortion, banned gender-affirming care. I mean, all of the things are happening there. The NRA strutting around the floor of the state house with everybody bowing down to them. And what do people like us do is, First, they tune out because they feel like they have no power. But then you start to realize that there are more of us than there are of them, but they are louder and they have power. At least there. And having talked to them, I know you don't agree with me.
What do you mean us?
And the people who generally believe that we should be living in a democracy and that human rights are important. Let's call it that.
Yeah,
that's what I see as an us.
That's a premise that most Proud Boys would agree with. That very sentence, right?
Yeah.
Most of the fascists that I've spoken to, absolutely. Some will say, well, we're not a democracy, we're a republic or whatever. And then some will go just say, like, more actually the elite intellectuals will say, to hell with democracy. When I say fringe, I'm talking about liberal left folks, right? We're not the majority. I'm talking about the sort of the assumptions that drive the media, of which I'm a part, right?
Right.
The ways in which the most conservative audiences I've gotten for book events for The Undertow have been in New York City. I mean, I don't even want to go there anymore. I haven't been to Indiana, but I go to any red place. People know what I'm talking about. They're living with it, right? In New York City is questions like, well, maybe we can work with Joe Manchin. They still imagine that they are the center and that the center will hold and that these are kooks or that they're going to age out. How many times do we get to hear that fascism, that the young are going to save us? I'm 51. I've been hearing that since I was
51 too. Right.
Yeah, we didn't save us.
No, we didn't, certainly.
And a whole lot of us, Gen Xers, in fact, are now the problem. This generation's different. It's more diverse. So is fascism. I respond to that like, we're the majority. So what? Very few fascist governments have ever had majority support. I guess when I say, like, what do you mean by us? I'm thinking, where is fascism identifying one of its current front lines? It's always moving. It always needs a new object of hit. Right now, it's trans folks, right?
Yes.
They are on the front line. Now, you and me, I assume, we fully in trans rights. We're nowhere near the majority. I say this from Deep Blue, Vermont, where a trans family just got ran out of town. The town came together, town hall style in Deep Blue, Vermont, to say that this trans kid couldn't be in the volleyball locker room. We are not on the left at a moment of convergence the way fascism is. And I think the majority might be the majority who vote for Joe Biden. We'll see. We don't know. But there's no comfort in just saying, don't worry, just as long as the sleeping giant wakes up, we'll be okay. And I know you're not saying that, but I hear it again and again and again. It's one of the things I hear in New York City. You know, well, we're in the majority. Right.
Yes. But also a lot of those people are just counting on other people to go vote. And that's enough, which isn't clearly. But also, I think I had a really hard time conceptualizing how I wanted to talk to you today. And I usually don't. Usually I kind of know what I want to say. And I think, A, it's you questioning my assumptions too. But B, it is kind of a jumble. I know that the people I work with care very, very deeply about trans rights and women's rights and racial equity and are working really hard to do it. But I also know that here in Massachusetts, people are like, whew, thank God, whew, it's there, it's not here. And for now, right?
I'm in Deep Blue, Hanover, and our school district is under legal duress from wealthy Dartmouth grads who want to stop trans rights. This is the reassuring idea, well, it's just some old hillbillies or something like this. No, it's actually suburban educated folks kind of leading this fight. Who elected Glenn Youngkin in Virginia? You know, it wasn't, it was those kinds of folks. And I think that not only that idea that in Massachusetts we're safe, I mean, you're not in Massachusetts. I mean, town by town by town, it's sort of like one of the things that I discovered driving across the country. We go to a militia church in Omaha, Nebraska. We also go to one in Northern California. And at that one, in fact, someone volunteered, like, oh, I can give you just a string of armed churches down the coast. You can just drive down the coast, go into armed churches, right? So you see this in different places in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin. I meet a militia guy, but he is mild-mannered compared to the violent separatists I meet in Blue New York. There are concentrations, but this idea that the fight is elsewhere, the idea that there are blue bubbles and that you're safe because you're in your blue bubble is, I think, you know, from my experience of traveling across the country through this book and over the years, a way of not seeing those around us. I remember New York Times, Nicholas Kristof, this is maybe back in the 2010s. And he said, you know, he had discovered religion. Hey, did you know that there's religious people around here? He had discovered that there was someone in the New York Times newsroom who was a Pentecostal Christian. Well, let's leave aside the fact that New York City is probably the largest concentration of Pentecostals in the United States history. And a hell of a lot of folks there are Pentecostal Christians. They're not paying attention. They're not looking. This is in New York City. This isn't Brooklyn. This isn't the Bronx. I think we let ourselves, and I know you're not speaking this, you're actually going and doing this work in Indiana. The slow civil war is heating up because of the complacency that those of us in those blue spaces have. And I can't tell you how many times doing interviews for this book, after the interview, some interviewer will say, in Massachusetts or somewhere else, will say, you know, I know it's ridiculous, but I wouldn't mind if we just like separated the states. I'm like, you're as out there. The person who says that is as out there as the militia and is willing to sacrifice all your friends in Indiana and all the folks in Indiana who are being raised in a fascist way.
So do you think that's simply blinders because it's easier or because people want to believe that you can reason or fact check your way out or reach people? I think this whole conversation about Trump's interview with MSNBC and why didn't they fact check it and blah, 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 I think is so beside the point that it's ridiculous. But why do you think that we're so complacent, or is it a different question entirely? Am I asking the wrong question?
I mean, there's lots of reasons. Certainly is media failures. That's a big, big part of it. I'm pretty openly critical of the New York Times. I'm also an occasional contributor to the New York Times. But whenever I say something critical, oh, I get this wave of folks saying, that's why I canceled my subscription, because I know they're secretly working for Trump. No, they're not. And this is media illiteracy. And boy, have you made Trump tremble when you canceled your New York Times subscription, you know? I mean, this is a little bit of our failure to engage with the messiness of democracy. The New York Times has terrible reporters and good editors and bad editors, and their whole line is a little bit diluted, but it's a vast organization and they have resources that nobody can match. We need them, and we need local papers. I think part of it also comes from, and here's where I think this will upset people, a failure to grant humanity to the other. I am not saying let's all get along. I am saying when, you know, people say, how can we talk reason to them? I can't talk reason to the Dartmouth educated folks trying to attack trans rights in my school. I can't talk them any more than they can talk me into not believing in trans rights. They know what they chose. When you go out and you speak to these fascists, there's always this idea, well, they must just be deluded. And I'll just press this button as if maybe they haven't chosen this. And that when I say grant the humanity, I mean recognize that there are people that you interact with that are lovely, that also believe very, very different things. Here's a way to make it simple for anybody. Anybody who's ever had a medical experience has dealt with nurses. What a strangely pro-Trump line of work. I don't know what the statistics are. I know who you meet at Trump rallies.
Nurses. Oh my gosh.
I was the lucky winner of the genetic lottery of a heart attack at 44. And this was in 2016. And I was watching. I was hooked up to the machine watching Trump's second debate with Hillary Clinton, where he hovers around like an orange cloud, toxic orange cloud. And I wanted to see it because I cover this stuff. So I could see my blood pressure going up. And my nurse wanted to see it because he was a Trumper. And he was saving my life. And I know him. He's a nice man. He's a nice man married to an Asian immigrant. They're both nurses, very dedicated to nursing. And they believe some hateful things and support some hateful things. Those things coexist. I have to grant his humanity. His humanity is what saved my ability to keep being human. And once I recognize that, it's a little bit something like, oh, this whole situation may be quite a bit different than I understood. You know, you stop to get a cup of coffee. Who are you buying your coffee from, you know? I mean, in the same way that, like, I think about this, the blue bubble of New York City, I always remind people there's more Trump supporters in New York City than there are people in Vermont. There's more Trump supporters in California than there are people in New England. Is that, I might be wrong on that, but it's close.
It's got to be close. I mean, I'm from California. There's a freaking lot of people there. I grew up in the sticks, the like edges of Los Angeles County, you know, Los Angeles.
What's fascinating is there's a sort of centrifuging effect. And wherever I traveled around the country, and I think this is what people recognize too, I started the journey in the title essay, The Undertow, in Sacramento, mm-hmm. and I meet this young couple, and they're leaving. They're thinking of going to Oklahoma with their kids. This is California. They're not white, sure. by the way. They're Latino, but they're thinking of going to Oklahoma. This is not a place to raise kids anymore. And then I get to New York, and in Palmyra, New York, is the family, and they're moving inland too. They won't tell me where because they're not sure they can trust me. And when I go to book events, I keep meeting people from Texas, from Florida, oftentimes families with either a queer person or a queer person in their family, and they're feeling out of safety. They have to move. So mm-hmm. that centrifuging is happening. And that is sort of creating some purification. That is no safe solution. When we think about the guys with guns who line up outside libraries, right? Well, I get this, yeah, but there hasn't really been any shooting, which is not entirely true, but there hasn't been anything massive in that regard. The metaphor is you're striking matches and flicking mm-hmm. them into dry grass, and lucky break, it doesn't catch fire. Then I guess this is okay to keep doing. I
mean, right.
Every time you show up with a gun. Gun owners and theater goers know this about the loaded gun and act right. one, right? And that's where we're at right now. I think there have been shootings. There will be more shootings. What can we do to lower the temperature around them so that doesn't burst into flame, as so many want to happen now? And I think we can argue that Trump is certainly at least willing to try and drive that, if not desiring to.
Oh, I absolutely. And I think that Trump is not Trumpism. Trumpism will last far beyond Trump. Yeah. Whatever we call this American version of fascism, whether we call it MAGA or Trump or whatever we call it, is here. It's been here. And now it's louder and has come out of the shadows, although it's been out of the shadows before.
Yeah, there's the Klan history.
Yeah.
Never on a national scale quite like
That's
this.
True.
We never had a president quite like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
That he really is different and on a matter of scale. And I think two friends on the left who said, well, America's always been a fascist country. Or you hear people say, well, people of color are already living in the worst conditions.
Oh, come on. We know that's not the worst.
Black men are getting gunned down in the street. I'm like, oh, they're getting killed disproportionately and it's horrific. But there's plenty of countries in the world right now where we can go to see it get worse. And that's not like saying, be grateful for what you have.
It's no.
There are people talking about bringing it to that next level. We're hearing eliminationist language about trans folks, eliminationist language about Jews. And, you know, it'll always be moving, as we know. Fascism always needs a new object of hate.
Right.
And so that we see another thing, anti-trans protests have actually apparently declined a little bit. Cue the headlines, the fever has passed.
Right.
Just like when anti-Muslim protests declined a little bit, that was the end of the right in America, right? I mean, it goes back. I wrote about this in an earlier book of mine called The Family. Christian nationalism is a spent force in American life.
Mm-hmm.
And that line replays like a drumbeat every 5 to 10 years. Every 5 to 10 years. I'm now at this for 30 years. And how many different periods in my life with a new book has some editor said, oh, that's in the past now.
Right.
The struggle is long. And it's why The Undertow begins with these sort of weird, seemingly odd chapters about long ago, mostly forgotten singers and lefty singers. And the struggle is to remind us that the struggle is long. And if Trump comes back in 2024, what do we do?
We keep it, yes.
Yeah. I want to write this book to give myself some hope, to give my kids some hope. I couldn't be cheap grace, couldn't be false hope. And I teach in a college. There's a lot of talk about safe spaces. You know, I remember also from Arkansas, I believe, a legendary organizer named Suzanne Farr. When I met her, she was an older woman, seemed like a very much a Southern grandma. She was a radical lesbian organizer, had created a part of a lesbian living community. Local women fleeing domestic violence would come to them for help. And then their spouses would follow. And Suzanne and her comrades stood their ground and protected those women. There was a young activist with us when Suzanne told the story. She says, that's so wonderful. You made a safe space. And Suzanne Farr, in her best, sweet Southern granny voice, says, oh, honey, there's no fucking safe spaces. And That is, there are so sit for a while as possible not to be scared. There are safe moments that we make together. A safe space, that's static. That's, oh, right. I'm touching this tree. I'm in New York. I'm safe. You can't touch me now. You know, right. Like when you're playing tag. But there are safe moments. That requires fluidity, and it requires us to organize. It requires us also to know. And I think that's the other response. Like, why spend time knowing about these guys? They're just jerks. Why don't we learn about good things? No, we got to know. I think we have to
know, but we can't only know about the bad stuff. We also have to be reminded of what we're trying to achieve. There's these movements or organizing principles that David Pepper in Ohio is one of the originators of, which is in the States, so many state house seats go uncontested. Yeah. Right? Democrats are not contesting seats, and the people who win those seats without even having an election are among the most extreme. And so there's this movement to get people running in every single district so that in 10 years, right? It's not going to happen this cycle. It's not going to happen the next cycle. It's not going to happen the cycle after that. But like little by little, we move forward a little bit. Now that doesn't deal with the Nazis, but that at least activates a few of the people who have checked out because there's nobody who represents them. So I kind of feel like that's a little bit more grounded than the, we're all going to die in a conflagration or is everything's going to be okay.
Well, but there's different variations of that everything's going to be okay. So when I say like slow civil war, I'm not saying conflagration. It's all, we're all going to die. I'm saying we're in it. We're in it now.
Right.
We're in the struggle. I mean, I like, there's my heroes in the book, the living heroes, that are those teenagers that I meet in this small town, Black River Falls, Wisconsin. And it's a tiny little town. This isn't Madison. This isn't Milwaukee. This is a town where church looms over it, and there's the Black River. And I drive the day after Roe. I'm just driving around talking to people about this. And I see this young woman, not 5 foot tall, holding up a sign saying, your misogyny is showing. And people are driving by honking or whatever. And a local preacher comes, towers over her, screaming at her. He knows her parents. She did figure skating as a kid with his kid. You know, this is a small town. She's joined by a group of other young women and queer boys. And I think it is notable that there are no straight boys out there, but they are doing this work. Now, these aren't the Madison radical hipsters. These are the squarest small town kids you ever met. We go to Perkins because that's the only place to go. And we have late night pancakes and waffles. It's the student senate president. It's the, you know, all the student body, the band. They're nerdy kids. They're radical as hell. They know the conflict is coming. They're maybe a little too eager for it. They also are looking at this from this perspective of, I want to live here. I want to live in Wisconsin. I want this place to be okay. That's why they become the heroes in a book that doesn't have a lot of them, to be honest.
I think there are a lot of those kids across the country.
Yeah.
And not all of them are David Hogg, like making such a big splash, but, you know, the kids that have lived through the school shootings and the queer kids, which are many, many more than their, like our generation identifies as queer, is like 3%. And our kids are at like 25%.
And I think that is actually kind of astonishing. And, you know, I think of this when I talk to my own trans teenager, you know, and they are rightly pissed as hell about some of the challenges they face. So on the one hand, I say, they can't even believe the kind of high school that I grew up. There was two boys we knew were gay. One admitted being gay. And the only reason he wasn't stuffed into a locker every day is because people were afraid to touch him, you know? And I mean, the idea of the real F word, which isn't fuck or fascism, but I'm not even going to say it.
Yes.
That's how young people speak of it today now as the F word. That was vernacular, right?
Mm-hmm.
At that time, right? So that has changed. Well, great. We're making progress. On the other hand, my kid is now criminalized in 20 states and growing, right? And on the other hand, instead of pushing people into lockers and saying the F word, there's people with guns. And 400 million estimated, maybe probably more, Ryan Busey could probably tell us precisely.
Precisely.
in civilian hands. Mm-hmm. And I'm a gun owner, have been most of my adult life. This is different. This is really different. And as a person who's been out here reporting, you know, three times on this trip, that is the title essay, I got menaced with guns. That hasn't happened to me in the United States in those situations before. The risk is in saying that we've been through it before, lulling people into complacency and saying, we'll get through it again. How many times do you want to go up to the brink and count on it working out?
Right. But we also forget how bad it was in the moment, right? Like, we've been through it before, but it really sucked then.
Yeah.
Right? And I think by looking back and say, oh, we've been through it before, we'll get through it again, we forget how much it really sucks in the moment and how we can't be fighting the last war, right? We've got to be looking forward to what the next thing is. And I think also there are so many white Christian people I've talked to, liberal, who say, have we reached the bottom yet? What are you talking about? Like, no, we're near the bottom. We know where this goes. You know, I
got this great book, Diary of Anne Frank. It's a real page.
Yeah, right.
You're never going to guess what happens at the end. God. It's like, ha ha, but, you know, we just saw in Missouri, you saw the flamethrowers, and he's a candidate for governor. And people say he's burning books. And it turns out, no, he's not burning books. He's burning boxes that represent the policy. But just in case anyone else says, but once I'm governor, yeah, we'll burn books in front of right. the Capitol, right? And do most Missourians want to burn books? Absolutely not. There are more of us who don't want to burn books. There may be fewer of us who are willing to do what needs to be done to stop that from happening, right? Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot of people like, I'd rather we didn't burn books, but I have a soccer game this weekend, so I can't help, right?
Right, right.
And I'm not trained, I'm not Jewish, or I am, but I'm in a bubble and I think I'm okay or whatever.
Right. And there's so many people who are like, well, you know, the Republicans are really good at saying, you know, they're coming after you. And somebody I talked to said, but we, the Democrats, we always say you need to have compassion for other people. And I'm like, no, it's all us. You know, we're not in different groups of people. We're all in the line somewhere.
We're all
in line. Said, right.
Yeah, I think that's really important. It's almost sort of like our conversation today is becoming like, what are the obstacles to our fellow travelers seeing this moment that we're in? And one of them is coming from the best of places, right? We're a couple of educated white Jews. How horrible is it for people of poor people of color, the conditions they face? I just feel so sorry for them, right? Well, first of all, that's sympathy. It's not solidarity. And it's a way of distancing yourself. And it's a way of not understanding, as you say, like, yeah, that person standing in front of you in line, you know, the line that says to the left, to the right, right? Mm-hmm. But you're in the line. And not only that, I think there's also that assumption, like, they're just trying to make it, you know, so it's dangerous for everybody but straight white men. Nah, straight white guys, bad news. You're in the line too. Fascism consumes everything. We see mm-hmm. it again and again. Fascism depends on convincing people to hurt themselves. We see Trump announcing he's going to speak to the auto workers in Detroit. And we know that there will be some among them who will be receptive. Fools. But when it's their turn on the chopping block, I'm not going to just sit there and say, well, you brought this on yourselves. I'm glad to see it. Either we're against fascism or we're not. And I'm against it everywhere, every time, no matter who it's targeting. You work in Indiana. It's targeting a whole lot of people who vote for it. It's ruining their lives. West Virginia, the opioid crisis, Vermont and New Hampshire, where I am. You know, the people who vote for this stuff and get their lives ruined by it. We need more of our liberal friends to be thinking in terms of solidarity, not sympathy, and not the kind of sort of like, I don't want to center myself. Well, don't center yourself, but also don't fool yourself and not thinking you're there. You're targeted. I think of a great work of anthropology, the book of, I was talking about Jerry Falwell, the book of Falwell by an anthropologist named Susan Friend Harding. And she goes to this religious right leader's megachurch in Lynchburg. And she sees it. He tells the same story. This is sort of prelude to Trump, week in, week out, but with different variations. You can see the lies real time. So is a congregation disenchanted? No. In fact, they know. They hear it. They're enchanted. They also feel like they're collaborating. And because what is the story he is really telling? What is the fact? The fact here is power, right? Mm-hmm. The rest is all interchangeable. And it's why Trump doesn't particularly, fact-checking Trump will never work because he's telling the truth. The truth is power, right? Mm-hmm. I have power. And they can see that. The rest, oh my God, these fools quibbling over, you know, this detail or that detail, missing the, you know, the forest for the trees. And I think that is, that's the question when we were talking before about fact-checking. You can't fact-check power, right? You can't fact-check a myth, as I argue in the book, partly because a myth is in service of power. And if it's working, it's working. It's not, right. It throws it out. I always love that note that the opposite of fascism is not anti-fascism. That's just a tool to get you to the opposite, which is a vibrant democratic culture. A vibrant democratic culture is not about the strong arm use of power.
Not that we should exercise raw power, but if we have levers at our disposal,
yes,
to make an institution or society more democratic, we should be doing that and not shying away from that simply because afraid of leveraging power.
That's where I look at something positive. For instance, the Washington Post creating a democracy beat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Saying, we are actually on the side here. We are not neutral on the question of democracy, right?
Absolutely. I think the press is a separate conversation, but it needs to understand that if there's real fascism, they lose their ability to be there in any free way. And
good news there, which is it's better now. It's not nearly good enough. Or we look at the debate over coverage of trans issues in the New York Times, and it's been bad.
It's been terrible.
But it's been a fight. The fight hasn't won, but it's been a fight. There's a lot of people at that paper who are saying, hell no. And they don't have the power yet, right? I want them to take the power and let's get some sane coverage. But I think, like you're talking about horse race coverage, yeah, I hate to admit it. I'm surprised that we're quite so horse race now as I was on January 6th, even though really, you're really going to do this again.
Right. We didn't learn anything with Hillary's email. Seriously?
I think they did. When I talk to folks privately, so many of them know they just can't figure out what else to do. And I think there is something there. I think it is hard to figure out what else to do. You know, that's how we always tell that story. I think that's the element of where we say fascism in 2023 isn't like it is in 1936. How we write about it in 2023 can't be like it was in 1936. We need to find these new ways of telling stories. I'm not going to say, go buy my book because I figured it out. If I had, fascism would be gone step by step. You're doing it in your podcast. I'm doing it here. Other people are doing it on Twitter. Other people are doing it in organizing. But we have to be finding these new ways of stories. And the good news, I think that not enough. It's a minority. But there are at least journalists now who I see in mainstream places. I'm talking about journalists who go out and report.
Right.
And some of them are doing that. And I think they haven't figured it out yet. And they're going too slow. And they may be too slow. And we may be doomed, but we're trying.
We're trying. And on that note, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thanks for listening. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. We thank you for choosing Freedom Over Fascism.